You're tuned into KJuice 770-880 in the UCSB Residence Hall dorms, and this is the official radio show of the Santa Barbara Independent, Poodle Radio.
Sunday birds swinging low, and the fever in your brain only grows, and the murder boys are running down the street. You can see them through the window from your seat, hear the sound of the mighty. And the shadows go like ghosts across your room. Oh, take the world and burn it in a spoon. A mercy ship to sail you off to sleep, to where the crimson angels swim the deep. There's no hiding from the mighty. With every breath you drink in the night, you won't give up your blue without a fight. And looking at the sky, there is no pain. See, the stars are falling down like burning rain. They were fired by the mighty.
This is KJuice 770-880 in the UCSB Residence Hall dorms. My name is Colin Marshall. Welcome to Poodle Radio, the official radio program of the Santa Barbara Independent. And a little bit of background first. What we just heard, by the way, was a singer-songwriter, or I should say who we just heard, was a singer-songwriter by the name of A.A. Bondi, or AA Bondi, don't know what he prefers to go by. He is appearing at... Well, he's coming right to town, right here in Santa Barbara. He's going to be at Muddy Waters down there in sort of the edge of downtown over on Haley with the opener Willie Mason on Monday the 18th. That's going to be the Monday following the broadcast of this show at 8 p.m. There's an article about that, by the way, in this current week's issue of The Independent. That'll be volume number, let me look over here, 24 and number 209. That gives you a little bit of insight into the concept of this program, by the way, because every week, as it stands now, we're going to have some features relating to the articles, the pieces, the coverage, the news stories, the art stuff, the reviews, and all that in The Independent, and plus other stuff on the side, going a little beyond the paper's purview as well. So we're going to serve a lot of interests here, and I think have a lot of fun. This is actually a reboot, you might say, of an earlier iteration of Poodle Radio on this station, KJuice, which is the AM version of KCSB here in Santa Barbara. But that had not made the transition to KCSB proper, although there's no reason it couldn't have. I think putting in one more quarter here on K-Juice, then we'll make our jump over next quarter to an FM time slot. Until then, you can enjoy this show two ways. Number one, you can, and if you're hearing what I'm saying as I'm speaking it right now, you can tune in, or you are tuned in, by pushing your radio up against the wall to pick up the electrical carrier current running through the residence hall dorms at the frequency 770-880. Or if you're not hearing me right now, that means you're hearing me later after the show has been posted to the Santa Barbara Independence website. That's going to be up as a form of podcast. Maybe we'll get that in RSS feed or something later, but that'll be up there as well for everyone who is not in a certain select number of dorms here on the UCSB campus to listen to. So right now, two ways. Next quarter, there will be a web stream. That'll be, of course, the FM signal. Very cool, but for now, let's have some more fun. Let's hear another song, perhaps. We're going to go on forward to another band who has recently made a Santa Barbara appearance, or will make a Santa Barbara appearance. They'll have a connection one way or the other. Here on Poodle Radio on KJUC, or KJUICE, 770, 880 AM in the UCSB residence hall dorms. KCSB, or rather KJUC, the AM version of KCSB, 770, 880 AM in the UCSB residence hall dorms. The show is Poodle Radio, the official radio program of the Santa Barbara Independent. My name is Colin Marshall. That band was Asobi Seksu, and I believe that is a Japanese name, although only a partially Japanese band. And Seksu, that second word, I think is a cognate, a Japanese-English cognate, so shouldn't be too hard for you to find out the connotation there. In any case, they played recently here in Santa Barbara. Looking at my advanced listings here, they played just last Thursday, the 14th, at Soho. I hear it was a fine show, so any of you who were there, there's a little look back, a little listen back, rather, at your memories from that Thursday evening performance. I'm sure it was as intensely wall of sound as that one track was, and for those of you who weren't there, well, there's a little taste of what you missed. We've got so much more on the way tied to this week's issue of the paper, including, well, the cover story is the Winter Arts Preview, a guide from pop music to classical music to visual arts to dance to theater, all kinds of stuff going on this winter season in this arty town of Santa Barbara. I've got a couple features up ahead that kind of go along with that theme. I've conducted an interview with Elizabeth Schwitzer, who is an associate arts editor at the paper. She's going to talk to me about dance and what we can look forward to as far as dance and other performance art of that type this coming season, as well as an interview, with DJ Palladino, who any cinephile around Santa Barbara will know is the man who heads Magic Lantern, the cinema program here in Isla Vista, kind of by the Santa Barbara campus, for those of you unfamiliar, which has been going on in its current form for a few years now, since I believe 2003, 2004, but the history of the Magic Lantern Theater stretches all the way back to the late 1960s. He'll be telling us about that era as well. So stay tuned. It is Poodle Radio on KJUC, good old KJUCE, 770, 880 a.m. in the UCSB Residence Hall dorms. Plus, of course, the show is available on the Independence website.
This is Gil Scott-Heron with some bad news. It's called angel dust. It's a killer white powder or a chemical mix that is sprayed or sprinkled on tobacco or marijuana cigarettes. It has come between the best of friends. Don't sell it, buy it, give it, or take it. In other words, don't mess with it. It may leave someone close to you very dead. That's no way to treat a friend. That's no way to treat yourself. It just ain't worth it.
The West Side Boys and Girls Club hosts free lessons on how to mix and scratch. It's free and for all ages, every Monday and Thursday night from 6 to 8 p.m. For more information, call 818-439-6948.
February 4th through the 14th, Rumble Art presents their International Contemporary Art Fair in downtown Santa Barbara. Rumble Art will be open daily from 11 a.m. to 11 p.m. You can learn more at rumbleart.com.
won't lose the beat if you just keep clapping your hands. Like sweet, sweet potato clap for the ruminant band. You had a broken lung and a bit of tongue. Did the load in the warm wet fields on the moon and under sun.
KJUC or KJU 770-880 in the UCSB Residence Hall dorms. My name is Colin Marshall, your host of Poodle Radio, the official radio program of the Santa Barbara Independent. That cut was from a band called the Fruit Bats, a side project of a guitarist from a band you probably know the name of. If you don't know the Fruit Bats, they're getting better and better known, the Shins. And you do know the name of the Fruit Bats, guaranteed, if you've been paying attention to who's going to be coming to Santa Barbara, because of course, they are one of the bands who will make their way here. They've got a show on Wednesday, the 27th, a little bit in the future, over there at Soho. If you'd like that cut at all, maybe that's something you want to look into. You can get a little more information about that at independent.com or in the paper as we get a little closer to that date. As I mentioned earlier, as I teased, as they say in the radio business, I have a segment coming up to do with our Winter Arts Preview, which is in the paper right now. It's on the stands. You can go ahead and check it out for yourself. Going to go a little in-depth, though, into the dance portion of things. Santa Barbara, as it turns out, I didn't know this, it's a pretty good town if you want to see dance. If you're a dance fan in Santa Barbara, you are probably not doing without. I talked to Elizabeth Schwitzer, Associate Arts Editor and coverer of many things dance, many if not all things dance there for the paper, a big dance enthusiast herself as well, about just what it's like to be a dance fan in Santa Barbara, plus what's going on this coming next few months, this winter season. What can we look forward to? What can she look forward to? And what can the prospective dance fan look forward to who maybe wants to get into the art form, but as with many, is kind of, it's a bit confusing about where to start. Let's go straight to it then. Without further ado, my conversation with Associate Arts Editor Elizabeth Schwitzer on Poodle Radio on KJUICE 770-880. In the UCSB residence hall dorms. Elizabeth, when I was reading the sort of advanced materials on the dance events coming up this season, I was actually surprised at how much there was going on. How typical is this? Is this actually a lot, or do I just feel like it's a lot because I don't know that much about dance?
I would say it's pretty typical these days. Arts and Lectures has really picked up speed in the past 5 or so years with dance programming. And so those are some of the really big highlights every year. But there's also just a real range of dance events going on, from community-based stuff to touring companies. So I would say this season is not an exception, but it's a good one.
What is getting you most excited as a viewer of dance, as a fan of dance, sort of in the next, say, month, the early third of the season?
Well, Christopher Wheeldon, who is a London and New York-based choreographer, is bringing his company to town, Morphosis, on Tuesday, January 26th. I think that's the right day. Wait a minute.
I have that as the 29th. Might
it's
be the 29th?
It's Friday the 29th. That's right. Grupo de Rua is the 26th, and that's another Arts and Lectures program. But Morphosis is a new company. Wheeldon is kind of a superstar in the contemporary ballet world. Arts and Lectures is also screening a documentary about his experience going to Moscow and setting a new ballet on the Bolshoi. So there's kind of a chance to get some advanced education about Wheeldon and who he is and what he's up to. But I'm really expecting that performance on Friday the 29th to be a satisfying one.
What can you tell us about Wheeldon as this superstar of the dance world today?
Well, I don't know if I'm the best authority on everything Wheeldon's done in the past, but he has been with the New York City Ballet as a resident choreographer, which is just about as high as it gets in the contemporary ballet world. He's set work on international companies kind of all over Europe and the States. And he's young. He's in his 30s and just really go-getting. And he's working with some of the best and brightest ballet dancers from the New York City Ballet and other international companies and bringing them together for Morphosis.
What after that, later in the season, are you also looking forward to?
In terms of major highlights?
Well, I suppose so. I suppose we want to give our listeners an idea of what's major, but also B, what is super exciting to you yourself as well, the personal touch.
In terms of larger name companies, Akram Khan, who's based at Sadler's Wells in London and who does Indian Kathak dance, kind of blended with contemporary dance, is collaborating with the National Ballet of China, and they're coming to town at Campbell Hall with arts and lectures February 16th. And I'm just fascinated with that because it's a great example of international collaboration. And it's actually a piece that focuses on questions of national identity, and it's based on the concept of the Tower of Babel. So it should be really rich, interesting, and unusual partnership. So that one is exciting. And then for me personally, I'm excited about Nectar, which is a new showcase for performing arts based in Santa Barbara, mostly local or Southern California performers, coming together every couple of months. And this winter we've got one on February 20th at Yoga Soup. And the organizer, Sybil Gilbertson, is a longtime professional dancer from the community. She danced for Santa Barbara Dance Theater for years, but she's really excited to bring together artists of various disciplines to address difficult topics. So she's had a showcase based on issues of violence and war. She's done one on suicide. And the one coming up in February is based on the body and sexuality. So I just think getting artists from this community together to address topics like this in new ways in a really welcoming and expressive environment is a really exciting one for Santa Barbara.
Now, how have those previous performances there, the ones that deal with subjects kind of equally heady, war and such, how have those gone over before? Has it been as sort of, it could stir up some controversy in the dance world, but then again, I'm not sure what does stir controversy in the dance world, so you can enlighten.
I think the whole idea is to stir up, if not controversy, then at least, a real dialogue and some emotional responses. I've been to the last two the first and second of these showcases, and they are emotional. They also attract an audience who really is willing to dive into these questions with the performers, and it feels like a really kind of a collaborative experience that embraces everybody who's there as part of that experience. And she's bringing in also representatives of nonprofit organizations who can speak to these topics. So she had somebody from the Glendon Foundation for Suicide Prevention there, last month or 2 months ago when that was her topic. And I think she's doing a good job of kind of setting the stage and creating a space that's educational as well as kind of risk-taking.
So you mean there's a combination of actual discussion of the topics at hand, but also with dances that surround those subjects?
That's right. And it's not only dance. She's welcoming performance artists of all kinds. So there are spoken word artists who've taken part in the past. There are films, slideshows, singer-songwriters, so it really is quite a broad showcase, but Sybil's background is in dance, and quite a lot of what's being brought to the stage there is movement or dance-related.
And now I have to draw on what you know about dance as an art form. This is a question I think that's going to come into the minds of people listening, is they'll hear about, and I'm sure they've read about, whether or not they're into dance, they've read about performances that do, as we've said earlier, address certain questions and confront certain themes. And I'm sure they think about that old quote, I forget who actually said it, but how, for example, writing about music is like dancing about architecture, the implication being you can't dance about anything. I'm guessing there's a refutation to that yes, you can dance about things.
Well, I think as you can probably sense from the breadth and scope of the different artists and companies coming to town just this season, that there are as many ways to create a dance and to conceive of what a dance company or performance is as there are individuals. And as in any art form, I think you find a range from people who really want to do narrative works. You know, Swan Lake is a story. The Nutcracker is a story, down to the most abstract, most contemporary, and the most rarefied, removed from story movement scores that you can get. So there's a huge range. I don't think there's any answer in particular to your question that I can provide. But, we've got everything looking at dance this season from the Spirit of Uganda, which is a group coming to the Granada to share African drumming and dance and, you know, cultural traditions from that country, to Bash, the annual showcase of ballroom, Argentine tango, swing, salsa, and hip-hop. Again, kind of a cultural expression from a number of different cultures. To Larry Kigwin, who's going to be here later in April from New York, but creating a piece that's welcoming Santa Barbara community members, not necessarily with dance experience, to create a dance that says something about what our community is and what it represents. So, you know, there's all kinds of different ways to get people up on a stage moving their bodies from the most narrative to the least.
That sounds incredibly difficult, recruiting community members regardless of their level of dance experience, and I don't know if the average person has much dance experience. That, do you know anything about how he plans to handle that? How he plans to make use of those resources he has in community members?
Well, this should be really exciting. This is courtesy of Dance Works, Diane Vapnick, who at one time ran Summer Dance Santa Barbara, which went on hold in 2006, and we were saddened to see them stop programming for a while. But she's come back with a collaboration with the Libero Theater. She brought Azure Barton from New York last year, and that was just a huge success in this community. And Azure Barton really is an up-and-coming contemporary dance superstar, acclaimed all over the world right now. So Larry Kigwin is this year's visiting artist. He'll be doing a residency at the Libero in April, but he'll be Saturday, January 16th at noon, which I think, unfortunately, is just a couple of hours before this show will actually air.
Yes.
But there's an open call to members of the community who are interested in what this well-known, successful New York choreographer might be thinking when he says, hey, I'm interested in people who represent the community of Santa Barbara, whether they're surfers or yogis or accountants or philanthropists, to come together and, in the first instance, just talk about what makes Santa Barbara Santa Barbara, and then begin to explore how we could stage that. So he's done an equivalent in New York. This is a Santa Barbara version. It's called Bolero Santa Barbara, and it'll be one part of a production to be staged at the Libero in April. And I'll be there. I'm excited to see who turns up.
Now, how would you say the amount of what I'm going to sort of amorphously name dance awareness, how does Santa Barbara's awareness of dance as an art form compare, you think, to cities that are comparable to it?
Cities comparable in size to Santa Barbara?
Yeah, I would say so.
I think we have a really sophisticated dance community and dance audience in Santa Barbara, and I think that is thanks in part to Summer Dance Santa Barbara, that for 10 years brought some really nationally and internationally significant artists to Santa Barbara and taught the community what was available, often out of New York City, but not always. And also to Arts and Lectures, especially with Celesta Bellecci at the helm, which has really, again, raised the bar and brought some incredible professional touring companies to Santa Barbara over the years. So, you know, there's no way to create a sophisticated dance audience without providing dance for them to view, and without providing some of the really fascinating post-show discussions that Arts and Lectures often provides. So I think in the past decade or so that I've been watching this dance community in Santa Barbara change and transform, I've just seen a kind of a renaissance.
And from looking at what's coming down the road this season dance-wise, and from talking to you about these events, there seems to be just such an internationalism that's going on. We've mentioned Uganda, we've mentioned Argentina, we've mentioned Akram Khan's collaboration, his Chinese collaboration. Is this representative? Is it reflective of a current trend in the wider dance world to sort of fuse these disparate seeming influences from all around the world? Or has this kind of always been going on in to some extent?
That's a good question. I think that may be the case in some ways, certainly in the effort that all artists are always making to distinguish themselves, to find funding, to branch out, to explore vibrant collaborations, you know, dabbling in different ethnic forms and going into different countries' dance traditions, just to find inspiration and to reach out is one direction that I've seen quite a few companies go in. But I also think, you know, dance is part of so many traditional cultures around the world. So if we're going to be bringing companies from outside Santa Barbara to visit, there, it's one thing to bring contemporary dance, which is fairly American. It's a fairly American art form. But organizations like the Multicultural Center at UCSB, Arts and Lectures, lots of programming organizations really look to diversify and to bring, you know, a range of art forms. And when you're looking at the full range of what's available in terms of physical movement, it's natural to think about traditional dance forms. I mean, they exist in so many cultures from way, way, way back.
And given the range of dance offerings that are happening in Santa Barbara this season, what then would you recommend for, let's say someone's listening to this, they haven't been to many dance performances, they don't know a lot about the form, but they figure maybe, considering all that's on offer, this is the time to get into it. Was there something going on you'd recommend them first? What should they attend? What should the novice dance enthusiast, I'll say, attend?
I mentioned in passing Grupo de Rua. They're coming to Arts and Lectures from Brazil. They're a street dance company. They'll be there Tuesday, January 26th at 8 p.m. at Campbell Hall. And I've never seen Grupo de Rua, but street dance, especially for younger people, but really for people of any age, is a pretty exciting and pretty immediately, viscerally satisfying and accessible dance form, I would say. It's an all-male company. It should be really high energy. If you ever watch MTV, if you watch So You Think You Can Dance, if these are kinds of forms that you're familiar with on any level, then I would expect that the music and the movement of Grupo de Rua will, you know, feel more familiar maybe than a classical ballet. So that's one thing I would check out. In terms of slightly more contemporary and closer to home, the annual showcase of new choreography called New Works is going on at Center Stage Theater above Paseo Nuevo. That's January 22nd and 23rd. And that's just a really great opportunity to see what kind of work is being made here at home by a real range of choreographers, and what kind of dancers live and work here in Santa Barbara.
And I guess I should ask this to follow up quickly. What kind of dancers live and work in Santa Barbara?
Santa Barbara's got a couple of professional ballet companies. State Street Ballet is one, and Ballet Santa Barbara. We've got Santa Barbara Dance Theater, a contemporary company that's been around for decades under the artistic direction of Jerry Pearson, and they actually have their own show, The Golden Dawn, at UCSB's Hatlin Theater, running through Saturday the 16th.
They can actually see a performance this evening, correct? This being
that's
the broadcast
right.
of on Saturday.
That's at 8 p.m., I believe, at the Hatlin Theater on campus. So there are certainly lots of classically trained dancers, ballet dancers here in Santa Barbara. There are quite a lot of contemporary dancers. There are a lot of people who dance in addition to holding down part-time or full-time jobs in, you know, other industries. And like in New York or any other big city, dancers often have to find a way to make ends meet outside of their passion.
And finally, where can listeners read all about, you know, what you've previewed as far as dance this season in the current issue?
Oh, it's part of our winter arts preview. So shouldn't be hard to find. Flip to the table of contents in the paper that comes out Thursday, the 14th of January, and you'll find it there.
Excellent, Elizabeth. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on the first reboot of Poodle Radio.
This is KJUC or KJUICE 77880 in the UCSB Residence Hall dorms. I'm Colin Marshall, host of Poodle Radio, the official radio program of the Santa Barbara Independent, doing its first edition of its reboot this broadcasting season here on KJUICE. As I promised earlier, we're going to have an interview with DJ Palladino, who's a film reviewer at the Indy. Plus, he's the head of the Magic Lantern Film Program. Anybody who's recently taken in a good movie in Isla Vista, well, you've been to Magic Lantern. You've been the recipient of the programming wisdom, in part, of DJ and his dedicated crew of students. I talked to him over the phone about the behind-the-scenes workings of Magic Lantern, the selection process, what he's looking forward to in the future, and especially the coming quarter of Magic Lantern. Without further ado as well, because we're kind of running short on time, here is my conversation with DJ Palladino.
In Rebecca Bachman's article on the on you and on Magic Lantern for the Indy, she talks to you a bit about your days as a teenager going to the original Magic Lantern Theater before it was the Ivy Theater that hosted the Magic Lantern program, which you now head. Could you tell us a little bit more about that? I'm curious what it was like and sort of what you saw in those days.
Well, you know, it was really a cultural center for people my age. You know, I just to give you some context, I graduated from high school in 1970. And so I started probably going out to Isla Vista on my own about, 1968, 1969. And, Ivy was the same as it is now, only completely different. It was, the same buildings are there. So every time I go there, I have this, like, flashback experience, you know, non-drug assisted. But it was livelier. There was more cultural stuff going on. There was music everywhere. There were a lot more shops that were run by younger people. There were bookstores, and Magic Lantern was a pretty amazing place. Not just because it had this great movie theater, which first opened in 1965, a little before my time, but it also had this fantastic bookstore there. The Red Lion Bookstore was basically where Theater 2 is now. And so there was this bookstore that was just beautiful. There was the theater that had, you know, all the movies that we wanted to see, and it was late 60s. That was a lot of stuff. And across the street, there was Borsodi's coffee shop. So there was always stuff going on in that hub. But really, what you're asking is, what did I see? We saw all the great movies, you know, the New Wave films, you know, Truffaut and Godard, and Bergman films were coming out at that point, or maybe they were in revival, maybe they were a few years old, but we saw that was the place where you went to see them. And besides that, there were the kinds of movies that were being booked in there were, you know, youth-oriented for our age, you know. So I saw Woodstock there in 1970, and I saw Easy Rider in 69, and, you know, all these films that we were, you know, that were like cutting edge for us kids. So, you know, it was a great place. It was really a hub in those days. Does that answer your question?
Certainly. And when I went through, I've been going through a lot of old issues of the Daily Nexus.
Oh, neat.
For a KCSB historical project specifically, but I'll see these ads for the Magic Lantern Theater. Uh-huh. And they'll have some pretty wild stuff. I'll think to myself, wow, I never even knew this theater, this building had such a past to it. But
can you remember any specific things? It'll probably jog my memory.
But mostly what I remember there is I would see from the mid-70s or early 70s, there were a lot of articles advertising, you know, what they'd screen at midnight, or, you know, they'd have some occasional bills of horror films that were ironic even then, that sort of thing. Specific titles I don't recall, but
right.
The whole vibe of it seemed very, very different, kind of indicative of maybe what the difference in vibe was in IV.
Right.
On the whole.
And, you know, the theater itself changed hands in the late 60s, somewhere around the time of the riots, where it had been a mom-and-pop sort of art house. It was actually originally built to be a legitimate theater, but halfway through the building they decided they needed an art house there. And they got into trouble because they showed a film, the title of which is eluding my brain right now, but it had full female frontal nudity, which is de rigueur now. I mean, you can't really make a movie without, you know, that in it. But at the time, it was extremely shocking, and it was so shocking that they had to actually pass out a little piece of paper at the beginning so that people knew that they were going to see a naked woman when they walked in. And despite all these warnings and despite the fact that it was, you know, not porn per se, there was a district attorney's convention in Santa Barbara at the time, and they decided to make an example of the poor people that ran this theater. So they came in and shut them down during the filming of that. And that became like this cause célèbre on the campus. The students came out and protested it. And ultimately, the family who owned the theater lost their court case, but I think this is true that they were only fined $1. So it was kind of a moral victory for them. But then by that time, they sort of had lost their will to go on in Santa Barbara. The Metropolitan Theaters took it over, and to their credit, they ran it. I mean, if you were just somebody, you know, Joe Blow walking around in Isla Vista, you might not even know that it had changed hands. They still were showing, you know, films that, like I said, you know, you see War and Peace one week and Frank Zappa's 100 Motels a week later, you know, things like that. And it was great, you know, it was really great.
How long did it remain, and before, of course, the introduction of the Magic Lantern film program as we know it now, how long did it remain a place to see cool movies in Santa Barbara?
You know, I went on one of my first dates with my wife in 1979, and at that point, the theater was being used by Metropolitan as a second-run theater, and we went and saw a Scorsese movie, and it was in revival. And so at that point, it was kind of fading away, and then they just let it go. I would say like in 80, they let it go. And the university bought it. I'm not sure exactly what the date was that they bought it from Metropolitan Theaters and started using it as a classroom. But even in the 90s, student organizations were using it as, you know, they would show films. And I've heard from a lot of people that actually it got quite debauched in the early 90s. It was famous for a place where, you know, the pot smoke was so thick when they were showing films that it was like 3D. You know, if you didn't get that effect from secondhand THC, you got it anyways. And then the police shut it down at the middle of a Cheech and Chong film, I think. And of course, Magic Lantern now is not like that. We're not like a 12-step program, but we're there, you know, mostly to give people an alternative to that drinking and smoking out and all that kids do. So, yeah, it lasted probably well into the 80s, and then we revived it as a regular film forum 6 years ago.
I came to Santa Barbara, to UCSB, in the early 2000s, and this was before the Magic Lantern, in its current iteration, started up, I believe, and I was actually somewhat disappointed when I showed up, and considering the proximity to Los Angeles Santa Barbara has, there didn't seem to be a lot of outlets for what I've previously called in this conversation cool movies or quality cinema. But then I do recall I was reading, of course, the article Rebecca Bachman wrote with you, and I was recalling how great it was to be able to see Sideways when it was screened. I believe the first in America to screen it.
We were the first people to charge money for Sideways. That's true.
And yeah, I very much enjoyed that. Was that the kind of the beginning of the Magic Lantern program?
That, you know, I'm looking at the first program that we had for our first series, and it was the third film that we showed. We opened up with a movie called Saved. Oh, no, second film. We opened up with a movie called Saved, and then the second movie we showed was Sideways. And we were very fortunate. We had a relationship from the very beginning with Roger Durling from the film festival. And it was sort of through him that we got this film, that he had planned to do a screening, and then it had fallen through. And at the Arlington, they were going to do a screening, and he still had the print. So it turned into be our second screening was like an Academy screening. You know, it's funny because we only had about maybe 50 people there. And 2 weeks later, people were lining up at the Riviera and getting turned away. And my friends were calling me up and saying I couldn't get into that movie. And all I could do was, like, you know, cuss them out and say, you know, you could have come for free 2 weeks
later. You had your chance.
Yeah, if you just dared to come out to Isla Vista, you know. But the students came out and saw it, and, you know, and it was terrific. And we really do sort of try our best to make the lineup a combination of, you know, big blockbusters that we think will get tons of people there and art films that we think no one else, you know, is going to bring to town. Right now I'm working on trying to get the John Woo movie Red Cliff.
Oh, yes.
Do you know about it?
Yes, I do. I haven't seen it, but I know about it.
Yeah, it's only played in Los Angeles, and it's John Woo. It's not even, you know, like way out there in some weird avant-garde plane, but no one brought it to town, and so we're doing our best to squeeze it into the schedule. And then on the other hand, I've taken a lot of flack from the students because I booked New Moon in there. A lot of flack, but those things fill the theater, and they provide a safe place for a certain audience, you know, young women mostly, but not just young women. And we're very happy to provide that kind of, you know, haven for them on a Friday night, Monday night. They can place that they can go to. So we try to combine the, you know, the really ultra hip with the cheesy sellout. Although they don't really think of it as a cheesy sellout. I mean, usually we like the movies, even the blockbusters that we put in there.
And there is a question I want to ask about the mixture, the breakdown that's involved there. But first, I do want to set up, how did it fall to you to head the program? How did you get positioned in such a way that you were looked to and said, here, take it and make this into something great?
Well, you know, it really was very casual when it first started off. Although the people who first began it, Chris Zilke and Christy Julin, were seniors at UCSB, and they started it as a senior film forum, I guess you would call it, on Friday nights. And they were so successful with their first screening. They screened Tron and The Big Lebowski, and they had Jeff Bridges show up.
I was there, I remember.
Yeah. They were so successful that they ended up like really generating a lot of excitement, and they were the ones who decided to start calling it Magic Lantern again. So they're really responsible for getting this whole thing going. And then the Ivy Arts Association, then headed by Catherine Cole and now headed by my friend Ellen Anderson, asked Magic Lantern to join in what they were doing. They were trying to promote culture on, you know, trying to get Isla Vista back to 1968, where there's a lot of culture on every corner. And so anyway, that they lasted for a first really successful first, I think they did spring and summer. And then they left to take jobs somewhere else. Now this is really going to sound bad, but my brother is the film advisor in the film studies department, and he asked me to come in and take over. So it's something that we like to call nepotism. But it was also supposed to be temporary. It really wasn't going to be. We were just sort of like seeing how it would go for one quarter and see. And then the first quarter actually didn't go so well. We lost a lot of money. But the second quarter really took off. And by that time, the university, especially the chancellor and the executive vice chancellor and other people as well, really started chipping in and supporting that. They both contribute a lot of money to get this program going. And then I don't know if I got the job by default or I actually proved myself. You'll have to judge.
I have a lot of good memories myself of just, even though it's only been a few years, of the films that I've seen at Magic Lantern.
Of course, I can't tell you how happy that makes me.
Well, I'm glad it does, because it's certainly, as I said before, alluded to at least, it was a surprise to me that there aren't that many places to see movies that are less mainstream in Santa Barbara. And I guess since you know about cinema in Santa Barbara, why is that, by the way?
Well, you know, part of the reason is that Metropolitan Theaters has a monopoly on the theaters here. It hasn't always in the last, you know, I've lived here since the late 60s, and it hasn't always had a monopoly. But it, in effect, does now, and that, you know, it really is kind of a benign monopoly. There are times when things have been really bad, and there have been also been times when they've been really good. I mean, it's a tough job to program theaters. You know, you have to take a chance, you have to put it into a theater, and you have to hope that people will come. So the Riviera has always been the place where art films went, where offbeat films went. And now the Plaza de Oro, I think, sort of secondarily works as the place where they put the, you know, the kind of more less mainstream and more exciting films. But it's an imperfect balance of things. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff that just doesn't come. And I also think that the young audience that existed in Santa Barbara, I mean, this is just my surmise. I don't have any statistics to back this up. But I don't think it exists as much as it did, say, in the 70s and early 80s. No, so I think it's tougher for them to kind of bring in things. And lately, I think, I have to say that I think they've been a little cowardly in their sort of, you know, programming things. They haven't brought lots of things. All you have to do is pick up the newspaper and look and see what's playing in Los Angeles at the Lemley Theater on Laurel Canyon. Do you know this movie theater?
Oh, yes, I've been there.
And there's like six movies that you've never heard of almost every time you pick up the paper. And, you know, so you know, it's a combination of things. But there have been times when there were really great art houses that were outside of the Metropolitan Theater District. And they have, you know, there was a theater on Victoria Street for many years that really ran great stuff, foreign films, revival, it was kind of, what do they call it, Repertory House, you know, where they play play something for 3 or 4 days. A man named Paul Argenbright, who had been here, who was still in town, as a matter of fact, ran it, and it was really exciting. And, you know, it's not easy. And, you know, I mean, it cost me almost $1,000 to bring a movie in. So when I bring a movie in, I have to balance that with attendance, you know, so I have to make a calculation. And my calculations usually made out over the quarter. So if I do well with three films, I can bring in three or four films that I don't expect to do well with, but I really want to show.
Right.
You know,
right.
This coming up quarter, we're going to show A Serious Man, which you may think that is going to do well, but I actually don't think it will do very well.
Really?
I hope I'm surprised. We have the Santa Barbara International Film Festival screening on February 12th. We usually bring in a movie that's, like, you know, amazing, but no one's ever heard of it. Last year, what did we even bring in last year? We had some incredible film. We showed in Bruges 2 years ago.
Oh, yes.
Which
yes,
is one of the great films of the decade, I think. But nobody knew what it was when we played it. It hadn't been released theatrically, so, you know, maybe 40 people showed up for it. I'm trying to think of what else. You know, this quarter actually looks pretty safe now that I look over at the listings. Where the Wild Things Are, I think when we first booked it, we thought it was going to be big, but I'm not so sure it'll get a gigantic turnout. What do you think? Do you think people will come for that?
It's hard to say because there was such buzz leading up to the initial theatrical release of it, but the buzz then dropped off quickly. So I don't know, maybe a lot of people didn't see it, but now will think, hey, wait a minute, you know, I never saw that because I stopped hearing about it, but here it is in my own backyard and I can see it again.
Right, right. And so we always hope that that's going to be the case. And Fantastic Mr. Fox may or may not do really well. It's a wonderful movie. That's on March 5th. And, you know, usually summertime, we spend the whole summer just showing movies that we think are cool, that you know, because we don't get a very big turnout, we just say, oh, the hell with it, and we just put whatever we can in there, or whatever we like in there. And so we've done really, really great things. You know, we showed a bunch of the movies from the, do you know these movies from the Six Shooter series?
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
And we showed almost all of those at this point. I think we showed four of the six. And we had to slide those in, and, you know, A Big Man Tokyo, which was an amazing movie.
Oh, yeah, I love that.
We showed last year. Well, we probably got like 18 people at every screening, you know, and they
were... What happened? Did someone not show up to promote it and put up posters or something?
No, we had great postering. We do a lot of things in the news. Well, the Nexus doesn't run during the summer, so that makes it hard to do newspaper ads. And then we do, you know, but you know, we just find that the more esoteric we get, the lower the attendance is, with certain exceptions. And I always feel really proud of the students. Like, we showed The Fall last year.
Oh, I was there.
Yeah, an amazing movie.
Yes.
And it had actually come in out on DVD the week before, which is usually this, you know, if something's come out on DVD, we probably won't even show it because it just cuts the audiences in half. You know, this beautiful film that nobody knew, you know, we didn't think anybody was going to show up. We had almost a full house for for three screenings, and I was so proud and happy. People just came out to see it. So you never know. Roman Baradiak, who runs the Arts and Lectures film series, always telling me, DJ, you can never guess. You can put in something in there and you think it's going to be, you know, amazingly. Well, okay, when I showed Bruno last quarter,
right,
I thought the place was going to be overrun. And it was about 25 people at one screening.
Huh.
Yeah. So, and then, but on the other hand, sometimes we get really pleasantly surprised. And, you know, and we're not really in this to make a lot of money, but the people who are supporting us at the administrative level really want us to try and break even and support ourselves. And that's something we would like to do, too. You know, the closer we get to supporting ourselves, the more freedom we have. I mean, we're already pretty free. I really have a lot of discretion in what I can book. You know, like nobody tells me you have to book these kinds of movies. So, and I rely a lot on what students say. I rely on a lot of what my assistant. Right now, I'm working with a woman named Layla Carrillo-Blodgett, who's really great. And I, you know, since she is 25 or 4, and I'm 50 something, which I won't say. You know, I pay attention to what she says a lot. So, and then when people just come up with suggestions, you got any good suggestions?
Well, I'm sure I could come up with a thousand of them. I'm sure I can send you an email about
Please
that.
Please do.
But there's. To close it, I want to ask a question that I know some of my more Magic Lantern going friends would sort of get angry at me if I didn't ask. Maybe it qualifies as a tough question. I don't know. But some of these Magic Lantern going friends, they got a little scared at the specifically the fall 2009 schedule. They thought that Magic Lantern might have been going fully toward the mainstream, we'll say. What can you say to allay these fears, to convince these people that Magic Lantern is in fact not turning into a service that sort of brings back what played already at the Camino Real Theater?
No, those are good. You know, that's a good question. And I think that if you look at, if you had it in front of you, the posters from the last 5 years, and you looked at the different seasons of how Magic Lantern works, it usually starts off in, you know, in fall with what we really end up getting to show are the residuals of the season before. Uh-huh. Okay, so what we show in fall are the summer movies.
Oh, I see. There's the cycle there.
So we're rich in blockbusters in summer, you know, when we come back. And if you look back, almost all the cases, we have all the movies that come out in summertime that are, you know, really, you know, either good or bad or whatever. But there are usually not that many art films coming out in the summer, and there usually is a lot of blockbusters. And then when you head into winter, it's the fall releases that are left over from before. And so if you look at this, you know, you look at fall, we have Zombieland, Where the Wild Things Are, Fantastic Mr. Fox. These are movies that came out after summer, at the end of summer, the beginning of fall, right? And so there was a stronger dose of, you know, art films and mainstream films. So, and we also have a wave of attendance in September that falls off in summertime. So by springtime, nobody comes to the movie, no matter what we put in.
Huh.
I mean, and usually springtime is kind of like the weakest one for, like, you know, so we get a little more adventurous in spring releases. And we have a smaller batch of, you know, things that we know are going to make money coming out. So look for spring and come to the movies in spring. When you're tempted to go to tempted to go to a party instead of coming out to see, trying to remember, like, well, Let the Right One In last.
Oh,
last,
I went to that. That's one quarter. Of my favorites in recent memory.
Right, and the kinds of films that we were able to glean from, you know, from the fall. And we, you know, we're able to put in and also, you know, we learned a lesson very early. Revivals just don't work. I mean, they just period don't work. Everybody told me, if you show Goonies, this theater, this was when I first started, okay, 5 years ago. If you show Goonies, people will just crowd out the theater. And I was like, okay, well, I like the Goonies. So there wasn't any problem. I booked it and I put it in there. And we had like 30 people come total.
Wow.
And everybody who we talked to said, I said, well, you know, you said if you know, we came, it would be crowded, and you didn't even show up.
Oh,
and they're like,
promised.
Well, you could see it on DVD, so why would I come to the theater and see it, you know?
Right.
So it's very hard to do the revival thing. We do it every once in a while. I don't know if you remember the 40th anniversary of Magic Lantern. Were you here for that?
I don't know if I was. What was the event that was?
We did a free evening where we showed the films that opened up Magic Lantern in 1965. And it was like 40 years to the day that Magic Lantern opened up. And we showed for free Citizen Kane and Monsieur Hulot's Holiday, which is what the auspicious beginning of Magic Lantern was.
I must have been out of town because I wouldn't miss that movie.
Well, we didn't even fill half the house.
Oh.
Free. So, you know, it's tough. Sometimes we want to, you know, sometimes we show films that there are films that we really want to show. No one's going to come to them, and we just have to do it because we have to, you know, we have to make enough money to keep this thing afloat. But I'm always open to listening to people's criticism, and especially more than open to suggestions for films that people want to see. And I'd love to hear from people who, you know, who think we're going soft. Well, maybe we're going soft. Who knows? You know, I'm not getting any younger, but...
Well, perhaps listeners will be able to give you some sort of feedback after they hear this.
I hope they do.
Well, DJ, thanks so much for taking the time to share your Magic Lantern memories and give us a look on the inside.
Thank you, Colin.
Hello. Can you hear me? If you can hear me, you're listening to Cages 7788 AM. In the UCSB Residence Hall.
This has been Poodle Radio on KJUC or KJUICE 770-880 AM in the UCSB Residence Halls. Thank you for tuning into the first installment of this reboot of the program. Be sure you tune in next time. Push your radio up against the wall, pick up the carrier current, or, on the other hand, you could download the show from the Independence website the following Monday. However you do it, I hope you'll hear us next time. Thanks, by the way, to DJ Palladino and Elizabeth Schwitzer, my guests for today, and all the musicians whose music we have played.